Okay, Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study. Thanks so much for joining us today. Next weekend is Shavuot, also known as Pentecost. The last few weeks I've been building up to Shavuot because I have a special presentation to give on Saturday week from today. Traditionally, Shavuot is associated with Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, and so I'm excited about this particular class coming up next week. I'm excited about the one today, but I'm also excited about the one for next week. So I would propose to you that Shavuot is the single greatest event in all of human history. I think that Shavuot, marking the 50th day, is the most important day on the biblical calendar. And I mean that. I'm going to have to share with you why, but I'll have to do that next week. So I would say that it's more important than Passover. I would say that it's more important than Sukkot and more important than Yom Kippur, even. Now, I know that there are people out there who say, well, I don't know, you know, Yom Kippur is the holiest day of the year and so forth. Well, I'm going to bring forth a case next week that Shavuot, if we associate Shavuot with the giving of the Torah, that is the most significant day in all of the Bible. But you have to wait until next week for that, right? So see how I've already tried to bait you into next week, so you have to join us. Today, though, today I'm teaching a class that I have entitled Ikavod, The Glory is Missing. In my head, I had the title, The Glory is Missing, The Glory is Gone, but in my notes, it's called Ikavod, The Glory is Missing. Now, last week, I started talking about the 10 words, and we talked about the testimony and so forth. Last week's class I entitled The Tablets, Take Two. And we went through quite a bit in that particular lesson, began to show the significance of the ark in biblical literature. So we talked about how the ark was constructed in the wilderness period, very shortly after they had left Mitzrayim, after they left Egypt, and it traveled with them, according to the biblical account, through the wilderness journeys. And I want to pick up from that point. I want to stress a little bit more. I want to go a little bit further to talk about the significance of the ark today as I lead into my class, Ikavod, The Glory is Missing. So we're going to go through quite a bit of narrative material and quite a bit of reading today, because I think some of these texts are very essential, very fundamental, very foundational in terms of stressing the importance of the ark in terms of the biblical storyline. So we're going to take it a little bit further. I want to start with the story when the children of Israel, having been in the wilderness for 40 years, Moses is dead. Moses, remember the book of Joshua begins, Moses, my servant, is dead. Miriam is dead. Aaron is dead. The entire generation which left the land of Egypt, that entire generation, because of their unbelief and so forth, they're dead. So this is a new generation coming out of the wilderness. And we're going to pick up in the story where the children of Israel with Joshua, remember Caleb and Joshua, according to the Torah, the only two that were allowed to go into the land, because we read about Joshua, he has a different spirit about him. He wholly, wholly, followed after Jehovah. So Joshua is the appointed successor of Moses. Joshua is going to lead the children of Israel into the promised land so that the land will be distributed. The land that God promised to the fathers will be distributed as an inheritance to fulfill his oath to the patriarchs. So what I want to do is we're going to begin today in Joshua chapter 3. Now, just so you orient yourself geographically, the children of Israel are in a place called Shittim. Now, Shittim is on the eastern side. They're going to cross over from Shittim to a place called Gilgal. Now, from Shittim to Gilgal is an interesting thing because in the book of Micah, the prophet Micah talks about if you want to know the righteousnesses, plural, of Jehovah, you'll look at this crossing from Shittim to Gilgal. It's in Micah chapter 6, verse 5. It talks about this. Now, the only way that you understand that passage is to understand that what it's talking about is the miraculous thing that took place when they crossed into the land, which is what we're going to talk about. So if you'll go with me to the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 3, I want to read a few highlights from the story of the crossing. So I want you to remember, we're talking about the importance, the significance of the ark in terms of its central place in all of these stories. So if you begin in Joshua chapter 3, and I want to pick up in, I just want to read verse 3. And they commanded the people, well, let's begin in verse 1. Joshua rose early in the morning, and they removed from Shittim. They came to the Jordan, he and all the children of Israel, and spent the night there before they passed over. It came to pass after 3 days that the officers went through the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, this is what they said, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah your God, and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall remove from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Come not near to it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way heretofore. So understand that the ark is going to go before the children of Israel in their crossing from Shittim to Gilgal, right, as they cross into the land that was promised. Now, I'm just going to pick up a few verses. Go down to verse 6. And Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass over before the people. And they took up the Ark of the Covenant, and they went before the people. So the image I want you to have in your mind is that when they cross over, the Ark is leading the procession. So the Ark of the Covenant is in the fore, and people are supposed to keep a distance from it, but these Levites are bearing it, and they're crossing through. Now, what I want you to realize is that a great miracle happens here. People often think of the children of Israel crossing the Yom Suf, the Reed Sea, the Red Sea, but they don't think about this miraculous crossing. It also happens around the time of Pesach, right? So it's very interesting. Now, I want you to go down to verse 7. And Jehovah said to Joshua, this day will I begin to magnify you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And you shall command the priests that bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the brink of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. So he tells Joshua, the ark is going to be in front, and when those who are bearing the ark, when they get into the Jordan, they're to stop. They're not going to cross over. They're going to stop right in the midst of the Jordan. Now, one of the things that I wanted to pick up is, we brought this up last week, but I really like that what Moses did anytime the ark set forward, right, whenever the children of Israel would move camp, when the cloud would move and the children of Israel would move, there was a particular order. This is described in Bamidbar in the book of Numbers. But what you have is Moses would declare a certain thing anytime the ark went forward. So hold your hand here in Joshua so that you get the feel for this. I might get John and Sherry and Dave and all to walk around through here and blow trumpets and all. But let's go to Numbers chapter 10. I want you to have a visual of this. In Numbers chapter 10, verse 35, and it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses said, "Rise up, Jehovah, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Now, anytime that the ark set forward, this would be declared. Arise, Jehovah. So this idea, there's an association in biblical literature with the ark representing the presence of the God of Israel. And they recognize that God was not, you know, the ark, but there is a very fine line. The ancient world, this ark is really associated with the divine presence. So this would be declared. And of course, I'll go ahead since I'm right here. When it rested, verse 36, he said, "Return, Jehovah, to the 10,000 thousands of Israel." So again, it's arise, Jehovah, and return, Jehovah. So anytime this ark is moving, it's associated with the presence of Jehovah. Now go back to Joshua chapter 3. Now, I'm going to read beginning in verse 9. I've got to go through some narrative material here in this class so that you get this picture in your mind. Plus, I think a lot of times people don't read very often these historical works, so you kind of they fall out of your memory. So it's very good to stay up on this. Verse 9, chapter 3, Joshua. "And Joshua said to the children of Israel, 'Come here and hear the words of Jehovah your God.' And Joshua said, 'Hereby you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Hivite, the Perizzite, the Girgashite, the Amorite, and the Jebusite. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth passes over before you into the Jordan.'" Now remember, what he's saying is, this is how you're going to know that a living God is in the midst of you. How? And that he's going to drive out these inhabitants, because the ark is leading the way. He wants everyone to see the ark. He wants them to visualize the presence of Jehovah in their midst, and this is the way it's going to take place. Let's see. "Now, therefore, take 12 men out of the tribes of Israel, out of every tribe a man, and it will come to pass as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests that bear the ark of Jehovah, the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off. Those waters that come down from above, and they'll stand in a heap. And it will come to pass when the people remove from their tents to pass over the Jordan, and the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as they that bore the ark were come to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests that bore the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its bank throughout the time of harvest, that the waters which came down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far from the city Adam that's beside Zaratan, and those that came down toward the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, failed and were cut off, and the people passed over opposite Jericho," this is where Gilgal, so they're crossing from Shittim to Gilgal, to the plains of the Jericho, it's called, "and the priest that bore the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel passed by on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over the Jordan, and it came to pass when they were clean passed over the Jordan." And the story continues. Now, so understand that as what Jehovah tells Joshua is, this is the day that I'm going to basically, in the eyes of all the people, show them that just like I was with Moses, I'm going to be with you. And he does this through a miracle, right? They cross through the Red Sea on dry ground. They're going to cross through the Jordan River on dry ground. Now, I assume that the water was a little bit more flowing at that time than it is today. Some of you are thinking, that's not a miracle. I've seen it. But at the time, he says, look, the waters even overflow during the harvest. So the waters at Adam, which is north of the crossing point, it stops. So you have a dry area of ground that goes from Adam all the way to the Salt Sea, and the people in mass cross over. Now remember, the priests are standing on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And this is how, according to Joshua, that you're going to know, you children of Israel, that there is a living God in the midst of you. Imagine walking by and seeing the ark and all that it represents. People have a confidence now that Jehovah's in their midst. Now go with me to chapter 4, and we're going to begin in verse 10. The priest who bore the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that Jehovah commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. And the people hastened and passed over. And it came to pass, when all the people were clean passed over, that the ark of Jehovah passed over, and the priest before the people. All right? So when the ark crosses over, after everyone else has made it through, if you read the entire narrative, which we're not going to do, the ark is called to the forefront again. So come back up to the front. And it resumes its station, leading whatever it is that the children of Israel do, wherever they go, the ark is there at the fore. Now, you'll remember, not only is the ark a big part of what happens when the children of Israel cross over, but when they go into battle, beginning with the battle at Jericho, the ark is part of the procession. Remember, the ark is to go in front, and it's actually behind the seven shofar-blowing priests. So you have the priests who are sounding the horns, and then you have the ark. And during the procession, the ark is central. So these are big stories that the ark is a central part of. It's there during the wilderness journeys. It's there when they cross from Shittim to Gilgal. It's there when they begin the conquest. And throughout the Hebrew Bible, periodically, we get stories of the ark being central in everything that's going on, everything that we believe the ark is in the middle of. When an altar is erected at Ebal, in Joshua chapter 8, remember, this is one of the things. You're going to set this altar up, and you're going to write the Torah upon these words, upon these plastered stones. Whenever that takes place, the ark is pictured as being in the center, and people, Levites, are on either side of it, and then the people are on either side of it. The ark is right in the middle of the story. Joshua 20, Judges chapter 20, says that it was kept at Beit El for a while. The ark then was moved to Shiloh, right, where the tabernacle stood, according to chronologists, for about 369 years, I believe. The ark is there. Now, the title of my class today, Ikavod, the glory is missing, comes from a very interesting story in the book of 1 Samuel. So if you will join me in 1 Samuel, the story comes from chapter 4 today. 1 Samuel chapter 4. And I'll give you a little background here. There is a battle that's ongoing with the arch nemesis, the Philistines. They've gone to battle. The children of Israel have gone to battle. And they've been routed by the Philistines. Some 4,000 men have been killed. And we're going to pick up in verse 3. And I want to read the story here. So it goes, when the people had come into the camp, this is after they've lost 4,000 men, the elders of Israel said, why has Jehovah smitten us today before the Philistine? I mean, what did we do wrong? In other words, they understand that in biblical thought, this is in all ancient cultures in the ancient Near East, when you won a battle, that your God gave favor to you. When you lost, you probably had angered the gods. They attribute victory to their God and defeat to their God. So their question is, how did we lose? Notice, let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah out of Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us out of the hands of our enemies. So a couple of things stand out here. One, they didn't have the Ark with them when they went into battle the first time. And now they're thinking, ah, it's no wonder. We didn't have the Ark with us. Go get the Ark from Shiloh, and we're going to bring it into battle with us, and things will be better. So verse 4, so the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah of Hosts, who sits upon the Kerubim. Notice, you see the literalness that's recorded here. The idea is that this is a throne for Jehovah. So they're saying, we're going to bring Jehovah into battle with us. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth trembled. This is a lot of warriors. And when the Philistine heard the noise of the shout, they said, what's the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews? And they understood that the Ark of Jehovah was come into the camp. Now, how did they understand that? Don't know, but they recognize that this is a different group now. In other words, they're emboldened, they're strong. These warriors are chanting and screaming. And notice this. The Philistine were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for there's not been such a thing before now. Woe to us. Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods that smote Mitzrayim or Egypt with all the plagues in the wilderness. Strengthen yourselves and act like men, O Philistine, lest you fall slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight. Right? So their idea is they recognize that in their opinion, God is now with the Israelites, and there's some concern, there's some apprehension, because they remember stories. They know that this God who's now in the camp, who wasn't in the camp when they beat him before, the one that's in the camp now is the one that delivered them from Egypt, delivered Israel from Egypt. So they're scared. But then someone in the group says, we got to act like men here. If we don't fight valiantly, we're going to become slaves to the Israelites. All right, so we're going to pick up verse 10. Now remember, the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah of Hosts is in the midst of them right now. Verse 10, and the Philistine fought, and Israel was beaten. And they fled every man to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the Ark of God was taken. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were slain, and there ran a man of Benjamin out of the army. Okay, so I want to stop here. Again, whenever the Ark came into the camp, there was exultation. The children of Israel felt like this is what got us defeated before. We didn't have the Ark. Now we've got the Ark and we're going to win. The Philistine beat them again. Not only did they beat the Israelites, they killed the high priest's two sons, or they killed Eli's two sons, and they stole the Ark. So they now have the ark in their possession. Now, this man from the tribe of Benjamin runs from the camp. He's running back to Shiloh. He's going to go back and he's going to report on what happened. And meanwhile, Eli the priest, he's old. He's close to 100 years old. He's a big guy. He's sitting. He's big. He's old and he's blind. He's just sitting there. But he knows when the man comes, he's going to get a report. Now, here is the story of the report. Verse 13, this soldier from Benjamin runs. And verse 13 says, "When he came, Eli sat upon a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God." He's concerned. The ark is not at Shiloh. It's off in battle. And notice where his concern is with the ark. "When the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, 'What's the noise of the multitude?' The man came in hastily and told Eli." Now, Eli was 98 years old. His eyes were dim. He could not see. The man told Eli, "I am he that came out of the battle line. Indeed, I fled today out of the battle line." And he said, "What's happened, my son?" The messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistine." Notice that. I want you to get the gravity of the situation as this reporter. He's out of breath. "Israel has fled before the Philistine. There's also been a great slaughter among the people. Your two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, are dead. And the ark of God is taken." Now that's like, he gives him all of this in a breath. "There's been a great battle. The Philistine have put Israel to the rout. They fled. There's been a great slaughter. Your two sons are dead, and they've got the ark." Bam, bam, bam. "And it came to pass," verse 18, "when he made mention of the ark of God." Imagine you just take this bad news, bad news, bad news. "When he mentions the ark, that he," Eli, "fell from off the seat backwards by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died." He was an old man and heavy, the writer tells us. "And he had judged Israel for 40 years. And his daughter-in-law, the wife of Pinchas, was with child, near to be delivered. And when she heard the tidings that the ark of God was taken, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman that stood by her said to her," notice she's dying as well, "'Fear not, for you've borne a son.' But she answered not, neither did she regard it. She named the child Ichavod, saying, 'Glory or honor,'" kavod is glory or honor, "'is departed from Israel, because the ark of God was taken, and because her father-in-law and her husband," and she said, "'Glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken.'" Your sons are dead. Israel's been defeated. Great onslaught, and the ark is stolen. When the daughter-in-law gets all the bad news, she too, now look, I'm not saying they don't see all of this as bad news. It's clearly devastating, blow after blow after blow. But the writer is careful to note that their primary concern in both cases, for Eli and for the daughter-in-law, is the ark. The glory is departed. Where is the glory? It's like, where is it? It's missing. Now, I wanted to make a couple of points as I get into the class today. Number one, the ark being the box, no matter how beautiful it was, did not bring victory. the ark did not save lives. Right? No matter what they thought, they had hopes that it would, but it didn't. Despite its significance in the history of biblical Israel, the glory of Jehovah, this is important, the glory of Jehovah doesn't depend on the presence of the ark. This box, it's coated inside and out with gold, with a lid, with cherubim on the top, with poles covered in gold, supported on the shoulders of the priest, the one which represented in the eyes of the people the presence of the living God in the midst of the children of Israel, did not truly represent the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It may have been thought of as the throne, may have been considered the most holy relic or object. But let me tell you something. You remember reading about the Urim and the Tumim? Where is that? This object, people don't even really know. You know, they speculate, what was it? Was it sort of a way? Does it mean lights and perfection or lights and completion? Did it light up? It's somehow part of the priestly garment. Did it indicate it was used in divining, if you will, or getting answers from God? It's mentioned throughout the Hebrew Bible in a few places. It's gone. Where is it? It's mentioned in Exodus 28:30. It describes how important this is, and it's gone. The ark, you know, from Exodus chapter 25 is one of the passages that describes what it looks like and what it's for. And remember what it contains. It contains the testimony of the living God written on stone tablets on both sides, mizeu mizeu, on this side and that side. It's so important, and listen to me, it's gone. Last week I read this, but it's I like the way it's worded, so I'm going to read this paragraph again. It's from Richard Elliot Friedman. For some reason, Friedman says, the biblical sources do not tell what happened to the ark containing the tablets of the Ten Commandments. I'm talking about later than this event. We know this was stolen by the Philistines. Archaeology, too, has shed no light on this at all. The disappearance of the ark is the first great mystery of the period, and it remains one of the great mysteries of the Bible. There's no report that the ark was carried away or destroyed or hidden, not even any comments such as, and when the ark disappeared, and we do not know what happened to it, or, and no one knows where it is to this day, the most important object in the world in the biblical view just simply ceases to be in the story. Now, ultimately, if you follow the narrative here, children of Israel do get the ark back. In fact, the Philistines bring it back. Didn't fare very well for them when they had it. And yet, the story goes on, as we covered in last week's class and in the dialogue afterwards. Ultimately, the ark came up missing more than 2,500 years ago, and no one knows where it is to this day. Now, I know there are claims, yeah, it's in Ethiopia. There's some who say, no, so-and-so saw it in the temple, underneath the Temple Mount. These are reputable people. They said they saw it. They saw it. It's there. There are archaeologists or people who claim to be archaeologists who said they've seen it and touched it or whatever. Look, the ark is missing. These people didn't see it. It makes for a good story, but I don't believe it. And the reason it's missing is because, like everything else in faith, improperly placed trust in something other than Jehovah causes that thing to have to be taken out. Now, it's like the temple. Go with me to Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah 7. Jeremiah 7, beginning in verse 3. Thus says the Lord of hosts. Now, by the way, the context is Jehovah tells Jeremiah, I want you to go to the temple and stand in the gates and declare this message I have for you to give the people. Right? He doesn't get to do this in a little hideaway. He has to go to the temple. He's later tried for this in Jeremiah chapter 26. They want to kill him because he says that the temple is going to be destroyed. So get that, understand that. Jeremiah is going into a den of thieves, basically, and telling the thieves what God wants him to tell them. And he's telling them that your trust is wrongly placed. All right? So we're going to begin in verse 3. This is the message. Thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust not in lying words, the temple of Jehovah, the temple of Jehovah, the temple of Jehovah are these. For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute justice between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your own hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense to the Baal, walk after other gods whom you know not or have not experienced, and come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are saved, that you may do all these abominations? Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? This is hard language. Like, who's he talking to? He's talking to religious leaders and people of that are going there to worship. Behold, I myself have seen it, says Jehovah. In other words, you're not doing this in secret. Go now. Remember, this is Jehovah talking. Go now to my place, which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel. And now, because you've done all these deeds, says Jehovah, and though I spoke to you from morning till night, you did not listen, and I called you, but you didn't answer. Therefore will I do to this house which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to the place which I gave to you and your fathers, as I've done to Shiloh, and I will cast you out of my sight, as I cast out all your brethren, the whole seed of Ephraim. Repentance is required. Now, I want you to understand that Jeremiah is preaching in the temple, not when it's at its low point. This is supposed to be a high point. You know what's happened right before this? A scroll has been found. During Josiah's days, the temple has been cleansed, So to speak. The bad's been taken out. According to 2 Kings 23 and 2 Chronicles 35, there's a great Passover before this happens. The ark is back in the temple. They've got all their... Look, you know what they think? We got our temple back. It's good for us. Jehovah shined on us. They're like the soldiers going into battle the second time in Joshua 3. Surely, this temple, the temple will save us. Jeremiah's saying it won't. Jeremiah said, if your trust is in this house, your actions, that doesn't offset the fact that this house is sitting here. This house, go to Shiloh. How many of you ever been to Shiloh? I've been there. He says, you go look and you see what it looks like there. The same thing's going to happen here. Look, in Jeremiah 26, when the trial hits and Jeremiah is brought before him, they want to kill him. They're going to kill him. Why? Because he has claimed that the temple's going to be destroyed. And somebody in the group says, look, what if he really is a prophet? What if this really is a word of Jehovah? We better not kill him. In fact, during the previous days, Micah, the Moreshite, also said that this place is going to be plowed like a field. They didn't kill him. They repented. So there's two sides. One saying, no, kill him. You can't say that about the temple. They placed their trust in the external. How many religious people today do this? It's all about the outside, not about the inside. Look, there are people today, their biggest driving factor in faith is we have to rebuild the temple. And we got to find a red heifer with not a single white hair. And as soon as we do all this, the glory of Jehovah is going to come back. In the meantime, we're going to study every detail of this thing and we're going to build it again. There are people, there are organizations, that's their whole focus. Listen, you build another one, it'll come down too if the inside isn't right. That's a fact. It can be beautiful. It can be gold and shiny. The priest can have the right garments with the correct thread on their tzitzit. Everything can be done according to the stipulations. But if the inside's not right, it's coming down again. Now, Jeremiah chapter 3. This whole chapter is powerful. Whole book. But Jeremiah 3, I can't read the whole chapter to you. You can read that on your own. But I want to begin in verse 11. Jehovah said to me, faithless Israel has proved herself more just than treacherous Judah. So this is, he's talking about both houses of Israel here. Go and proclaim these words toward the north and say, return, Shuvah, you faithless Israel, says Jehovah, and I will not frown upon you, for I'm merciful, says Jehovah. I'll not bear a grudge forever. Only acknowledge your sin, your iniquity, that you transgressed against Jehovah your God and have scattered your ways to the strangers under every green tree, and you've not obeyed my voice, says Jehovah. Turn, O faithless children, says Jehovah. I've taken you to myself, and I'll take you one of a city, two of a family, and I'll bring you to Zion, and I'll give you shepherds according to my heart, who shall feed you with knowledge and understanding. Let me tell you about these shepherds. They're not going to tell you what everybody's telling you. It's not going to be the most popular message. The popular message is, oh, I'm with you. I want to build the house too. I want it to be shiny as shiny can be. The teachers that are inspired by Jehovah are going to be saying, look, forget the house. Let's not worry about building that right now. Let's worry about fixing us. Verse 16, it will come to pass when you multiply and increase in the land in those days, says Jehovah, They will no more say the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah, nor shall it come to mind, nor shall they remember it, nor shall they miss it, nor shall that be done any more. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Jehovah, and all the nations shall be gathered to it, to the name of Jehovah, to Jerusalem, nor shall they walk any more after the stubbornnesses of their evil heart. Look, if somebody said, "We found the box," I'd want to see it. I'm not going to tell you a lie. I'd love to see it. But I would know in my heart of hearts that while that is fascinating, while that is wonderful, if the people aren't right, that box isn't going to fix a thing. It's not going to solve the Middle East problem. It's not going to do anything. Except cause more fighting, probably. Look, we're talking about shuv. Shuvah, shuvah. Return. What Jehovah wants is for his people to return with all their heart. Look at Jeremiah 4. Talking about return. If you will return, O Israel, says Jehovah, return to me. And if you'll put away your abominations out of my sight without wavering and will swear, Jehovah Chai, as Jehovah lives, in truth, in judgment, in righteousness, then the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory. The whole Abrahamic plan is contingent upon Israel returning to God. This is the key. Listen, it goes on. For thus says Jehovah to the men of Judah and Jerusalem, break up the fallow ground and sow not among thorns. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Circumcise yourselves to Jehovah. Take away the foreskins of your heart, you men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my fury come like fire and burn so that no one can quench it because of the evil of your doings. He's saying, look, if you don't circumcise your heart, it's for naught. It's for naught. The box won't save you. The house won't save you. Killing a lamb's not going to save you. No amount of sheep in the world, no rivers of oil. That's not what he's looking for. It's a matter of the heart. The return is a return of the heart. It is an internal thing. It's an inside job. Circumcision of heart is proclaimed in the Torah. Deuteronomy 10:16, Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 6. Deuteronomy is the only book that knows in the Torah about a circumcision of heart. Moses only talks about a circumcision of heart in Deuteronomy. Doesn't mention the other kind. This circumcision of heart works on men and women. It's what God really wants. Cut that fatness away from your heart. Sensitize it. Jeremiah knew this. He says, Jehovah speaking through Jeremiah says the same thing. See, Jeremiah recognized that a new covenant was needed. Behold, days are coming, saith Jehovah, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, though I was a husband to them. But this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days. I will write my Torah on their heart. It's Torah on the inside. Now, how in the world do we go about writing the covenant on our heart? Or do we do it at all? Is it the work of Jehovah? You know, we started last week, tablets take two. There's a question. Who actually wrote on the second set? Was it Moses? Was it God? Yes, God in the new covenant is going to write his Torah on your heart. God, Jehovah, is going to circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring. But you know what you're commanded to do? Circumcise your own heart. Look, it's two-way street. You have to do it. Jehovah says he's going to do it. You're not able to shirk the responsibility saying, well, I know I'm wicked as hell right now, but Jehovah's going to fix me someday. It's not the way it works. Isaiah 51 is instructive in this. Isaiah 51. You know, Isaiah 51 doesn't get the attention it deserves. It's a very, very powerful passage. It's so instructive because it's a message, listen to me, to you. I want you to personalize this message. Isaiah 51 begins and it says this. Hearken to me, Shmuelai, Rodfei Tzedek. Listen, hearken unto me, you chasers of righteousness. Chasers of righteousness. You who seek are one seeking Jehovah. So this group, I hope that's you. Chasers after righteousness, seekers of Jehovah, he tells them, look back. Look back. Why do you look back? Because he wants us to look at this most ancient path, because it's in the ancient path wherein the good way lies. And the prophets are constantly drawing people, walk therein. Of course, the people say, but we will not. Listen, I know that this message, it's going out, but a lot of people aren't willing to make that commitment. Ezekiel is told, look, your words are like lustful music. People listen to it and they say, let me listen to what he's got to say, but they won't do it. We're too concerned with the external. If only we had the ark, if only we had a temple, if we could just find a red cow that didn't have one white hair, we would be set. Would usher in the glory of Jehovah. It's not that simple. You could line red cows up from here to Michigan, and it's not going to make a difference. Verse 4, Isaiah 51. Again, listen to me, my people, and give ear to me. O my nation, for Torah shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment suddenly for a light to the peoples. My righteousness is near. My salvation is gone forth. See this idea, Torah will go forth. This is Isaiah 2. It's Micah 4. It's a Torah will go forth from me. Read Isaiah 2, Micah 4. And it's a light to the nations. Remember Jeremiah 4 says, look, none of this is going to happen unless you break up the fallow ground. He's talking about your heart. Your heart is hard. Break it up. Circumcise your heart. Or this isn't going to happen. Israel's not going to be a light to the nations unless they fix their heart. That's what the message is. After the white space, at verse 7. Hearken to me. Notice each of these places at the white space begin with this simple thing. Listen, 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 listen. Listen to me, you that know righteousness. Now remember, verse 1 was you that chase righteousness. The assumption is that by now they've caught it. Watch what he says. Listen to me, you that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my Torah. He's telling a group, the ones who chase after righteousness, the ones who seek Jehovah, listen, 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 the Torah is going to go forth to me, and you've got to get it on your heart. It must be on the heart. External doesn't matter. Verses 12 and following, Jehovah says that he's the comforter. Remember, Isaiah 40 begins, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, comfort ye, my people. These prophets, these teachers are going to go forth and they're going to declare that the warfare is over, that the sins are forgiven. Where does that tie in? It's part of the new covenant. This is what's different about it. Your sins are forgiven and so forth. It's about because. Why? Because the Torah is on the heart. This is what it's talking about. But in verses 12 and following in Isaiah 51, it's very clearly communicated. He says, why are you fearful of your mission? He's talking to the people in whose heart is supposed to be the Torah. Why are you fearful of that? And then he goes through several different things. He says, you've forgotten your mission. You've forgotten Jehovah, your maker. And he says, you know, the one that made the heavens and the earth. Why are you afraid to do what I told you to do? Don't you realize that the one who stretched out the heavens is the one talking to you? Now look down at verse 15. I am Jehovah, your God, who stirs up the sea that its waves roar. I mean, this is what he's saying. Look, Jehovah of hosts is his name. And I'm going to read the English and I'm going to tell you what it really means. And I have put my words in your mouth and have covered you in the shadow of my hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say to Zion, you are my people. One more time. I have put my words in your mouth and I have covered you in the shadow of my hand so that I might plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth. This is I've talked about this and talked about it, but I don't know that it's really hit me as strongly as it's striking me now. He's saying, Jehovah's saying that the reason he put his words in the mouth of this people and the reason he has protected this people is because they have a mission to plant the heavens. See, it doesn't say that I may plant heavens. That's the English. In the Hebrew, it says, I put my words in your mouth and I protected you to plant heavens. It's assumed that God's going to plant heavens. But that's not what it says. You've got God's words in your mouth, and you're protected so that you can plant the heavens. It's a mission. Look at Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, verse 21. This, as for me, this is my covenant with them, saith Jehovah. My spirit that is upon you, and my words which I have put in your mouth, shall not depart from you, out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed's seed, says Jehovah, from henceforth and forever. God's calling is without, how do you say it? It's irrevocable. The mission of the people chosen by God to bring heaven to earth is something that cannot be shirked. But how will we ever do it? It's so easy for us to say we have to wait. Jehovah is going to send the Messiah, and the Messiah is going to fix the world, and we're just going to wait on that to happen. And, you know, who are we? Jehovah's saying, just like Moses said, I can't speak very well. God said, who made a tongue? You don't think God knows our frailties and our weaknesses? That doesn't take you out of the mission. Jehovah's saying, I'm the one that causes the waves to roar. I called you to do this, now do it. But how? Well, we've got to go to the Torah to find that out. To Deuteronomy, of course. Deuteronomy has a prophecy, a prophetic text, that is a description of the new covenant. Anybody who's listened to me for any amount of time knows that I'm talking about Deuteronomy 30. Now look, specifically, I want you to go to verse 11. This commandment, which I command you this day, it's not hidden from you, neither is it far off. It's not in heaven, that you should say, who will go up for us to heaven and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. Nor is it beyond the sea, that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. The word is very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart that you may do it. This commandment is talking about the Torah. Remember, a Torah will go forth from me. You who have the Torah written on your heart. This is all tied together. This Torah is not too difficult. Really what it's saying is, it's not too wonderful, mysterious. You know, there are a lot of people out there who are going, well, you know, we have to look at the mystical interpretation of the words, and it's so deep, and there are all these wonderful mystical. Look, it's not that. It's not that at all. Straightforward. It's not in heaven. You know why? Because our task is to plant it on the earth. To plant it on the earth. By the way, in Isaiah 51:16, where it talks about to plant heaven on earth, that word nata is not like you're throwing seeds, you know, like just scattering them out. It means you carefully dig the soil. You put the plant carefully and you pat. You sprinkle and you pat. It's a plant. Your task, should you choose to accept it, is to take pieces of heaven and plant them on the earth. See? In your daily life, in your daily walk. Let your will be done. This should be our prayer. Let your will be done, Jehovah, on earth as it is in heaven. It's not too distant. You don't have to go somewhere to do this. This task is readily accessible wherever you are. It's not in heaven. It's not beyond the sea. Not too far. Look, I'll tell you a few others. It's not in a temple. It's not in a tent. It's not in a shrine. It's not in a box. It's not behind a veil. It's not the property of an elite cadre of priests who have exclusive access to its wonderful, wholesome, life-giving teachings. The word is very near to you. It's in your mouth and it's in your heart to do it. To do it. Isaiah 59:21, which we read, says that this word that I've placed in your mouth, it's not going away. It's in your mouth and in the mouth of your seed. Newsflash. The ark is gone. The ark can't save you. The temple is gone. The temple can't save you. The ark is not even going to be spoken of, nor come to mind, nor be remembered, nor mentioned, nor missed, nor made again. Here's something else you need to know. The glory will return. The glory of Jehovah will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. And that's without the ark. Ikavod? I'll tell you where the glory is. The manifestation of the glory of God is waiting on you. Return to me, saith Jehovah of hosts, and I'll return to you. Much of the world, Jews and Christians, are waiting on someone to come. Jehovah's waiting on us to return. Christians are waiting on a Messiah to return. God is waiting on his people to return. This is a standoff. I mean, it's clear that the ball is in our court. As we seek to return to him, it is appropriate that I say to you what Moses would say when the ark would set forth and when it would return. Shuvah Yehovah. Rivavot alfei Yisrael. Return, Jehovah. Myriads, thousands of Israel. Shabbat shalom.